Okay, thank you, Barry, for moderating this session, and thank you all for being here, for sticking it out for the whole conference. This is actually a repeat. Some people ask, how could you make a talk of your own during this conference, which you've been working on organizing? I didn't make a new talk. So this is a repeat of a talk that I gave in 2017 at the ASA meeting in Golden, Colorado. So if you were already there, feel free to leave. That's okay. I may be a little bit less coherent now than I was a year ago, which I'll see. So this talk comes out of a talk that I gave on quantum physics and Christianity at each of our local chapters across the country in 2016. And Dennis Venema gave a talk in almost every chapter last year at the beginning. And at the beginning of this conference, we had a sort of a default plenary session for a contributed talk, and that's what this happens to be as well. So we've started the conference with one of the national lecture tour talks, and we're ending the conference with one of the national lecture tour talks. So that's how it all worked out. And I'm focusing here on just one aspect of that talk, and that is as the title here, Quantum Field Theory, Personhood and the Trinity, Echoes and Resonances. I won't say everything I want to about quantum physics and Christianity. There's a lot more to be said, and I'm having a sabbatical next year and hope to write some more about these topics at that point. One of the key thoughts about physics is that it's about relationship. This might be surprising to you, but physics is about how things relate to one another. This has actually been recognized by many people, but it appears to me that in particular, our most fundamental theory of particles and forces, namely quantum field theory, demonstrates that the nature of particles and fields has deep echoes and resonances with the way in which we are persons and the way in which God is Trinity. So echoes and resonances, not proofs or demonstrations. So I'm not trying to claim here that because of quantum field theory, we now know that God is Trinity and that humans are persons or vice versa. But there are echoes and resonances. And if some of you know Ross Hastings at Regent College, he's unable to be at this conference because he's at another event in South America this weekend. But he has written a book which has a very similar title to this, Coherence, Echoes of Coherence. In the world. So for me, the doctrine of creation brings up a wide variety of images and ideas for people. Genesis 1 and its various interpretations, other passages of scripture such as Psalm and Job and Psalms, a God who provides and sustains, a distinction between creation and providence, the creator-creation distinction, God calling forth creatures in their diversity, the beauty and or harshness of pattern and process, and God's eternal power and divine nature. These are all various things about the doctrine of creation that brings up the images that are brought up by that idea. Reflecting on the laws of physics from a Christian perspective, and I mentioned this already in my opening devotional today, God governs all things by establishing and maintaining regularities. In fact, I often think of this in terms of a covenant that God has with creation, and his faithfulness with that covenant is what enables science. So generally speaking, I believe that God reveals something of himself in the ontology of the world. And it may be that there's something in quantum field theory that can be instructive in this. So I'm very tentative and exploratory about this, but I think it's helpful. So a relationality in science. Physics is the discipline which studies interactions between things in the universe. There are clearly many ways in which such interactions or relationships are crucial. We talk about forces of all kinds by which things feel each other, like gravity, keeping the moon in orbit around the Earth, electrons pairing up, resulting in superconductivity. In their 1984 book, Order Out of Chaos, two Belgians, Isabelle Stengers, a philosopher, and Ilya Prigogine, a physical chemist and Nobel laureate, wrote, "For an interaction to be real, the nature of the related things must derive from these relations, while at the same time, the relations must derive from the nature of things." So this is what I'm going to be speaking mostly about and how that relates and connects with quantum field theory. So the nature of the electron is wrapped up in how the electron is related with other things and vice versa. Time and space are dynamic participants in the being of the world, and there's an irreducible dynamism about all things, given the reality of zero-point motion of atomic ground states and the poly-exclusion principle, both of which are responsible for things as mundane as the solidity of this desk, or this podium. So here's John Zizilias, a Greek Orthodox bishop and theologian born in 1931. He has said in this is an echo of patristic ontology. So the fact that relations and things are interwoven with one another, that echo that shows that connects with how the church fathers thought about being and existence. Colin Gunton, 1941 to 2003, was a British Reformed theologian. And he said these sorts of things in the book The Promise of Trinitarian Theology. Modern field theory has led to the conceptual echo. There's that word echo. It keeps echoing. Led to the conceptual echo of Trinitarian theology in relativity theory and its developments. So here he's not thinking about quantum field theory, but just relativity, special relativity for the most part. He goes on to say that the physics of relativity introduces a dynamism into the way things are conceived. There are no unchanging substances which enter into relations, as on the view of Aristotle and Newton alike, but the whole universe becomes conceivable as a dynamic structure of fields of force in mutually constitutive relations. Thomas Torrance connects this with perichoresis. So perichoresis, perhaps the simplest way to express perichoresis, and there was already some mention of that in Rob's talk earlier this morning. It refers to the mutual indwelling of the Father and the Son and the Spirit, the three persons of the Trinity. So the perichoresis, the word perichoresis has this word peri, which means about or around, and it has the word kora or korion, which refers to space or room or to contain or to make room or to go forward. So one of the ways that sometimes people refer to this is the dance of the Trinity. Perichoresis, God in three persons moving around, giving space to one another. This is the kind of was one of the ways in which the relations between the Father, Son, and Spirit are engaged. So Thomas Torrance says, the ontorelational concept of the divine persons, or an understanding of the three divine persons in the one God in which the ontic relations between them belong to what they essentially are in themselves. Along with this, there developed the new concept of person. The relations between persons belong to what persons are. So this is Thomas Torrance speaking more about what perichoresis is. So what it is to be God the Father is all wrapped up in the relation of God the Father with God the Son and with God the Spirit, and so forth. And Torrance argues that how we think of human beings, for example, is also dependent upon this way of thinking of God and this way of thinking of relationship. The relations between people belong to what we are. Our relations are not something sort of separate, added on later on. We sort of exist atomically, atomistically, independently, and then we are related to others. No, the relations are, they make up, they constitute who and what we are. A little bit more from Thomas Torrance. The patristic concept of perichoresis expresses something of the mystery of the Holy Trinity in respect of the co-inherent way in which the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit exist in one another and dwell in one another as one God, three persons. John in John's Gospel, Jesus says, I am in the Father, and the Father in me. So perichoresis, says Torrance, has essentially a dynamic and not a static sense, with the meaning of mutual indwelling and interpenetrating one another in an onto-relational, spiritual, and intensely personal way. So that's a little primer on perichoresis. And I'm going to say more about Torrance and personhood and also Maxwell a little bit, but I have to get on to quantum field theory. In fact, one of the challenges in writing this talk is that I'm not sure if personhood is an echo of quantum field theory or if quantum field theory is an echo of personhood. And I wanted to simply enter a superposition of states to have both directions of this connection simultaneously. So quantum field theory, what is quantum field theory? So I want to identify two specific things. that quantum field theory does for us in terms of a Christian perspective. First is that it nuances the notion that God governs things via laws. And secondly, it resonates with the ontological nature of relationship, both human personhood and the Trinity. So what is quantum field theory? Quantum field theory is, in a sense, a combination of quantum mechanics and special relativity. Quantum mechanics, the notions like Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the Schrodinger cat, Niels Bohr, and those people in the early 20th century, and adding on to that, Einstein's theory of special relativity that Merrick talked about a little bit as well. So quantum mechanics made relativistic is quantum field theory. And we talked a lot about nothing this morning with Rob's talk, the vacuum. The vacuum is a background C. The vacuum is not nothing. It's something which is fluctuating, which has the capacity to do all kinds of things. In fact, it has a capacity to undergo a serious transition to something completely other. So understanding the vacuum as being a dynamic thing is one of the consequences and developments of quantum field theory. And upon that vacuum, that background vacuum, there are excitations, and those are what we would call the particle. So the electron is an excitation on the vacuum of the sort of filled reality containing everything about the electron, and then there's an excitation, and that we would call the electron. And what is an interaction between two particles? Well, that's something that involves a mediation. A mediator particle. So Rob spoke about the gluon mediating the interaction between quarks. So how does a quark feel another quark? Through a gluon. And so these are some of the main points about understanding what quantum field theory is. So here is the first quantum field theory diagram. So these are called Feynman diagrams after Richard Feynman. We heard about Richard Feynman this weekend earlier. We heard sort of from him in a sense with the bongo drums. Here's Richard Feynman, and this is the first published Feynman diagram, which shows how two electrons relate to one another. So how do two electrons feel each other? They feel each other through a photon. So here is one electron coming along in time. So this is time and this is space. So time is vertical and space is horizontal. So an electron path would be here, for example, which would show that an electron is moving to the right. Here's an electron moving to the left. And the electron which moves to the left emits a photon, which is this wavy line. It then hits the other electron, which sends it off on its way. So this electron and this electron, those are the initial paths and those are the final paths. They have changed their paths because of the interaction between them. So that's the most sort of core way that two electrons feel each other through the exchange of a virtual mediating boson, in this case, the photon. So let me now focus on what quantum field theory tells us about the nature of a particle. And to be concrete, I will do this with respect to the electron. So what is the nature of the electron? It's true of any particle, but the electron is a good example because of its familiarity and simplicity, as well as its place in the first quantum field theory that we have, which is quantum electrodynamics. So here's the Feynman diagram of an electron coming from one side to the other. So the idea here is, what is an electron? And how does an electron get from, say, here to here? Well, the way that an electron gets from here to here, there are many possible ways that it can do so. So here's one possible way that an electron can get from here to here. So it comes along and then it goes this way, emits a photon. That photon, which has been emitted, turns into another electron and a positron. A positron is nothing but an electron going backward in time. On this particular diagram, I guess I have time. I'm thinking of it sort of as going to the right, if you will. And so this would be an electron going backward in time, which is a positron, which is a positively charged anti-electron. So that's what happens over here. In the meantime, this electron goes over here and goes off in another direction and emits a photon, which emits an electron-positron pair, etc. And they eventually all recombine and come together over here. So this is one of the things that the electron could be doing as it goes from here to here. So we call this the propagator, or this is a term in the calculation of the propagator of the electron. And Rob was an instructor of my particle physics class, so you can blame him for any misunderstandings I may have about this. this is one particular diagram. And of course, you could imagine there's other ways that the electron could have gotten from here to here. It could be that while it was going over here, the same whole set of things occurred. So there we go. So this is yet another way of the electron getting from here to here. It undergoes this along the way. So then you can see clearly how many such diagrams there are. There's an infinite number of diagrams. You can clearly demonstrate that by simply saying that anytime there's a solid line, you can replace it by this. So it's telling us that there are many, many ways that the electron can get from here to here. But it's actually a little bit more involved than that. The electron doesn't simply then choose one of those ways of getting from here to here, but in fact it does all of them. So the electron takes all possible routes simultaneously. So we have what is called the sum over histories. That is, if we want to fully appreciate the nature of the electron's movement from one place to another, we must include every possible thing that it could do. And it does all of those possible things. And adding them all up gives you the fullness of the nature of the electron. If we miss one of those, then the electron is different in its reality and its behavior. So this is telling us that the electron is not simply a little static particle sitting around waiting to do something, waiting to get interacted with by another electron. But as it exists, it is interaction. I'm not saying here that it is interacting with other things, but it in its nature and existence is an interaction. It is always involved in interaction. So there is no such thing as a passive, static electron doing nothing. It's always doing everything. So its interactions with the photon and with other electrons and positrons are built into its very nature. So you can't have an electron be simply a static particle. It is a dynamic thing. So one of the ways that this corrects our understanding of theological perspectives on the world is that we sometimes think of God having created a bunch of things in the world. And then God establishes laws for how these things ought to behave. So you might think, well, God created electrons, and then he said, let's make those electrons interact in a certain way. That fails. It fails horribly, because thing and law are actually entangled. So what it means to be an electron is its relationships with everything else. So instead of saying that God creates things and then imposes laws upon them, God creates lawful things. I'll say more. So I'll jump ahead to Maxwell and Faraday. So Thomas Torrance thought about James Clerk Maxwell's electric and electromagnetic field theory in the 19th century. And Torrance says that Maxwell saw that for Faraday, lines of force belonging to bodies were in some sense part of them. So this is a bit of a preview to quantum field theory in a sense. So when we have this diagram here, it shows a positive charge and a negative charge. They feel each other through lines of force. That's how Faraday perceived the interactions between them. And so we still work with electric field diagrams in this sort of way. We think of electric field as being, in some sense, connected to the positively charged particles from which the electric field lines point, and the negatively charged particles to which the electric field lines point. Those are somehow extensions of the particles, and those are the relations that they have. Torrance says that Maxwell claimed in a scientific point of view that the relation is the most important thing to know. Relations belong to reality as much as things do, for the interrelations of things are, in part at least, constitutive of what they are. Being constituting relations of this kind, we may well speak of as onto relations. Torrance on Maxwell: in the Reformed theological tradition, the notion of the person is held to be controlled by the person constituting and person intensifying activity of God in the incarnation, such that union with Christ becomes the ground for interpersonal relations in the church. Relations between persons have ontological force and are part of what persons are as persons. They are real person-constituting relations. That was the theology underlying Clark Maxwell's concept of union with Christ and of interpersonal relations in Christ, which it was not his nature to isolate in some compartmentalized way from his understanding of real ontological relations in the physical universe. For Maxwell, this is an article from the CSCA ASA Journal, Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith by Jim Neidhart. For Maxwell, central to the biblical understanding of the person is the reality of human relationships as an integral part of what persons really are. You as a person are not an isolated individual like the Newtonian particle separated from other autonomous Newtonian particles, but are interrelated with others, your parents, your friends, even people with whom you disagree. These interrelationships constitute the very stuff of personal being. This deep appreciation led to Maxwell's development of the electromagnetic field in order to describe particles as never separable from their interactions. And my point mostly here is that quantum field theory deepens and intensifies that that way in which relationships are integral to the nature of the particles themselves. Thing and law are fully and mutually entangled. So I will leave it at that for now and entertain your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Arnold.
Hi, thanks, Arnold. It's a very interesting talk. So I have two things that come to mind. One is the electron, you're right, it can't stop interacting with what it's able to interact with, but the interaction is probabilistic. Can that part be pushed into the theological realm, the probability of our interaction with other persons, with other relations? And the other thing I wonder is, if it applies to all persons, how do we understand the non-theist? What I mean, we would say, yes, our interactions are always with God, and we can sort of feel like that. But how do we understand those that are non-theists in this context?
Okay, thank you. I'll try to remember the second question while I do the first. So the first one is about probabilistic nature. So so it's important to note that these diagrams have weights. So that the simplest possible thing has the greatest weight, and then the next most possible thing would be a single photon being emitted and then reabsorbed, etc. And so these all have various weights, and we can calculate these. And so I should have mentioned that this Feynman diagram is a calculation. So it's an integral, multi-dimensional integral, which we can calculate and get an actual answer and use that number. In experimental verifications, and each term has a probability associated with it in that sense. So then your question is, how does that relate to probabilistic relations with God and so forth?
Or with
other people. So sure, so humans relate with other humans, and some of those human relations are much more intense than others. And there are many humans in the world with whom I have a very, very, very minor relation. Those relations are not zero, they're not non-existent. I have a relationship with every single other human being in this world. And those relations in some cases are sort of multi-step and are less, they're weaker, they've attenuated, right? And others are stronger relationships that I guess maybe connects a little bit with probability and the way that humans, that our own, each individual has his or her own network of people that they are built into and part of, which is different than the electron. Like for the electron, every electron is exactly the same. Electrons don't have that sort of individuality that humans have. And I guess similarly with God, some people have a stronger connection with God and a weaker connection with God. And that sort of maybe brings me into the second question, which is about how do we understand non-theists? Non-theists also have a relationship with God. They just aren't perhaps aware of it, or it's not a good relationship. And in fact, none of us have a perfect relationship with God. And I guess through Jesus Christ, we hope to achieve a stronger relationship with God and to see ourselves as God's children. In the case of the electron, I mean, there's one kind of interaction. It's just the photon between the electron. I mean, there are others. The various other ones are much weaker. I would hesitate to want to draw a quantum field theory diagram for individual people where they're mediated by God and by others, but there's things one could speculate on. I did a little bit of that, and Barry is telling me where the next question is coming from.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. It's quite an interesting topic. But I remember the notions in physics like uncertainty principle or the relativity. I remember the warning of Einstein. It's the relativity is totally different from the notion in like ethical relativity, and uncertainty is not related to any uncertainty in the real world. So I think it's a very good kind of analogous analogy, but any limitations of this analogy to relate the kind of a spiritual realms to the real material world or physical world, any limitations?
So are there any limits? Yes, there. So Paul's question is sort of taking on Einstein's warning. After the theory of relativity, there were moral relativists who were saying our moral relativism has now been scientifically demonstrated and we can now be legitimate moral relativist because it's been proven scientifically, right? And Einstein was horrified about that, and he wished he had called his theory a theory of absolutes, because that's what it really is. The speed of light is absolutely the same for all, and things like that. So it's dangerous to apply a scientific concept as if it simply applies somewhere else. And so this is why, I guess, my thinking about the quantum field theory and personhood and Trinity, I'm thinking of those as echoes or resonances in some mysterious sense, just saying that, you know, God's being as Father, Son, and Spirit has this perichoretic sense. But isn't it interesting that in this world we have electrons, photons, and they have this mutual indwelling as well? It's kind of striking, and maybe somehow an echo of how God is as Trinity and how humans are as persons. So there are other, I mean, I guess Maxwell said that the electric field is like that already in terms of persons and in terms of the Trinity. But I'm thinking that the quantum field theory is perhaps even a stronger echo or resonance than has been offered before.
I think it's a very good pedagogical purpose to show anything from another point of view. I think it's good for
that. Sure. So if people are experiencing this for this, you know, quantum field theory for the first time, it might be helpful to them, you're saying, to say, look, this is not totally separate from everything else. There are other things that have relations and whose relations constitute their being, et cetera.
I'm going to sneak a comment in with my moderator's prerogative.
All right, Barry.
Yeah, for your comment. I find the most striking analogy is the structure of the proton, where the proton's made of three quarks, and if you add up the mass of the three quarks, they don't add up to the mass of the proton. Most of the mass of the proton comes from the potential energy of the interactions between the three quarks. So you were probably going to get into that later. But
I wasn't going to get into quarks and the proton and all of that, but sure.
Well, my question is kind of related to yours, because this works really nicely if you have something like the electron, because it's perturbative. And so the higher contributions are smaller and smaller and smaller. But if you have something like a quark, it's not perturbative anymore. In fact, those higher order ones can be stronger than the simple ones. And so you can't do perturbative expansions when you're dealing with quarks.
So like quantum chromodynamics is still pretty tricky and complicated, and there are others in the room who are more able to speak.
Well, does
about that
have any theological implications too strong of an interaction?
I guess I'm not thinking of theological implications either of quantum field theory, but just more an echo or resonance. So even the fact that quarks interact with gluons and that gluons, you know, have this, the similar kinds of diagrams. I mean, they're different, but they have Feynman diagrams for quarks and gluons as well, right? And so that demonstrates also that quarks, you know, have their relation, their being is not settled by just talking about the particle itself. We have to talk about how it relates to understand its being. And there's a last question over here from Chris.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think of Thomas Aquinas's theory of the Trinity? Because he's conscious of the difference between substance and relation. In fact, he generates 4 centuries of discussion in the Latin philosophical tradition about the mode of being of relation. Because the mode of being of relation is irreducible to anything in the category of substance or incidental characteristics of things. So relations come into existence once you have a substance. As soon as the substance comes into being in nature, there's a field of relations generated. If the substance passes out of existence, the relations are still there because they're still connected to everything else in nature. So Aquinas is aware of this, but he says what's different in the Trinity is that the Trinity is relations, no substances, relations that are themselves subsistent, whereas in nature you don't have relations that are subsistent. So there's that interesting distinction between substance and relation and applied to the Trinity in this interesting way. I was wondering if you could comment.
I would have to read that. It sounds like it's worthwhile reading. I'm not able to comment on it because I hadn't really encountered Aquinas on the Trinity before. I would say in terms of quantum field theory, if you remove the electron, yes, the relations are gone, but the electron is still needed to be there for the relations. Yeah, if you would send me some good references, maybe it's in your book, that expound upon Aquinas and the Trinity, I will include that in my reflections in my further thinking on these matters.
Well, thank you. And let's give it a round of applause for Arnold.